the limelight.
Unfortunately, dirty politics have prevailed over religious injunctions in several Muslim states, or, to be more precise, in the policies of the heads of these states, who are neither the representatives of the people nor have any legitimate claim to rule, other than being under the protection of the enemy of Islam and Muslims, that is, the United States of America. Some of these states have, of late, not just adopted a negative posture towards Islamic unity, but have resorted to treachery by siding with the enemies of Islam and against fellow Muslims. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Impediments to Islamic Unity. Stay tuned for more. Ever since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has relentlessly strove to foster unity amongst Muslims following the different jurisprudential schools in the face of the feverish plots of the enemies of Islam, especially the Americans, the British, and the Zionists, to try to divide the Ummah. The annual Islamic Unity Week and the gathering of scholars of various Muslim denominations on a single platform in various parts of Iran and in several rural countries, with speeches emphasizing the benefits of solidarity and the dangers of disunity, is among the vivid examples in this regard. The Islamic Unity Week spans the two dates of the month of Rabiul Awwal, 12th and 17th, believed to be the blessed birthday of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This is ample proof that the Islamic Republic of Iran views both Sunni and Shia Muslims as brothers, treating the same path with only minor differences in secondary issues, since there is no difference between them regarding the fundamentals of faith. Unfortunately, dirty politics have prevailed over religious injunctions in several Muslim states, or, to be more precise, in the policies of the heads of these states, who are neither the representatives of the people nor have any legitimate claim to rule, other than being under the protection of the archenemy of Islam and Muslims, that is, the United States of America. Some of these states have, of late, not just adopted a negative posture towards Islamic unity, but have resorted to treachery by siding with the enemies of Islam and against fellow Muslims. One of the most vivid examples in this regard was the incident earlier this month at Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, in the Israeli-occupied Muslim city of Baitul Muqaddas, where Bahraini diplomats actively supported the Zionist armed forces against the oppressed Palestinian Muslims. Recently, in his memorable speech to the Iranian nation, which was televised to the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made it clear that the unity of Muslims is a definite duty and a Quranic order, pointing out that the decision of certain regional regimes to normalize ties with Israel is a great sin and mistake. He advised these misled rulers to return from this path, which is against Islamic unity, by making amends. Ayatollah Khamenei said the reason for his repeated emphasis on the issue of unity is the big schism which exists among religions, with the enemies are striving seriously to widen it. He pointed out, "You see that the issue of being a Sunni or a Shia has entered the American political literature for several years, while they are against the quintessence of Islam and hostile to it." In this regard, he took note of the recent terrorist blast martyring worshippers praying in mosques in Afghanistan, carried out and admitted by the macabrely murderous outfit Daesh. The leader posed the question, "Who is Daesh?" He provided the answer himself by pointing out that Daesh is the same outfit that the Americans, the same democratic group of the United States, explicitly said we created, even though they're not saying it anymore and deny it. He called for vigilance on the part of the Muslim Ummah worldwide, urging them to refrain from falling prey to the American, British, Zionist propaganda of Shia-Sunni divisions, saying, "Islamic unity will create synergy and strengthen Muslims and their hand in interacting with non-Islamic countries." Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the main yardstick for the unity of Muslims is the issue of Palestine, calling for more seriousness on efforts to restore the rights of the Palestinians for the sake of Islamic unity. "We earnestly hope the heads of Muslim states who have betrayed the Palestinians will reflect on their misdeeds, repent, and make amendments in order to return to Islamic unity by strengthening the ranks of the Ummah against the enemies of Islam and Muslims."
United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001. I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq war diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. For these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers, or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
Battle at Home, Part 2.
What the Army found after looking at thousands and thousands of deployments is that repeated deployments push you down the spectrum towards negative outcomes. Does that mean that if I went to Iraq for 12 months, I would come back a murderer? No, it doesn't. But does that mean that someone who might have been married and never had a problem with alcohol might get divorced and have a problem with alcohol, or might get arrested for assault or something like that? Yes. And can some people get shoved even farther down the line, or start farther down the line and get shoved even more? A lot of these guys that I wrote about are kids who didn't do that well in high school. They saw the Army as an opportunity because their other opportunities had been shut off. And they were good at what they were doing. A number of them said to me, you've got to be a little crazy to be in the infantry. And a lot of times the crazy guys are the ones who do the best in Iraq. But when they come back, they are already set up pretty low on the negative outcome spectrum. And when they start dealing with depression, PTSD, substance abuse, it's game over.
Kenneth Eastridge was open with Army recruiters about his criminal history, including a homicide charge as a juvenile. Several recruiters turned him away. But with enough persistence, Eastridge was able to convince one recruiter to enlist him despite his record of violence.
A lot of them were just kicked out of the Army for being bad soldiers because they were melting down emotionally. And once they were kicked out, they were sort of cut loose and had nowhere to go. They started drinking. They were carrying weapons all the time because they were extremely paranoid. They started using a lot of drugs. You put those things together with the training of an infantry soldier, and it's not long before somebody gets killed.
Courtney Lockhart enlisted in the Army after high school as a computer operator, but was deployed to Iraq as a foot soldier. Like many soldiers, he did not want to go to Iraq. His traumatic experiences in Iraq, including regular roadside bomb attacks on his brigade and the deaths of close friends, haunted Courtney upon his return from deployment. Like many of the soldiers in his unit, Courtney showed many of the signs of post-traumatic stress. He began smoking marijuana to calm his nerves from nightmares and paranoia, and was discharged from the military for marijuana use and violence, but was never screened for mental illness. In 2008, Courtney Lockhart abducted an 18-year-old girl from her college dorm, robbed and attempted to rape her before killing her with a handgun. Lockhart confessed and was convicted of the murder. The jury in his case recommended life imprisonment without parole, but the judge sentenced Lockhart to death by lethal injection.
One of the things that we've learned is, it's not, and the military has learned over the number of decades, it's not so easy to get people to kill. Until relatively recently, the majority of soldiers in combat never fired their weapons. Since World War II, this has become a major preoccupation of the military.
Surveys of American soldiers who served in World War II showed that only 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons, even when ordered to do so.
For most of us, it's very, very hard to shoot to kill somebody. So the military goes through great effort to teach soldiers to become killers, to desensitize them. And that's what basic training is about. There's all kinds of chants that are rather horrific about killing people because it's very hard. You have to get these people to not think about people that they're killing people.
As a result of these findings, the U.S. military intensified its training and conditioning of soldiers to fire at and kill the enemy. Some soldiers report they find it difficult to switch off this aggressive, vigilant mentality when they return home.
If a soldier reports mental illness or problems that they're having, that can have an impact on their career. I mean, if, let's say, an officer goes in and tells his superior that I'm feeling a little off today. I think I might be losing it. I'm having a difficulty, you know, maintaining a touch with reality. Well, are you going to give that officer a job that requires him to handle weapons, to handle increased responsibilities? Are you going to promote that officer? You're not. It's going to be career damaging to self-report that. And that's where I think you see a lot of increased rates of suicide, of alcoholism, and a lot of these other acting out scenarios that we've seen from soldiers who have returned after facing those kinds of stress.
You come back and you're supposed to fit into civilian society. You know, either people want to ask, what's it like being in war? And you don't want to talk, or they don't want to hear about it. They want you to come back and, you know, hug the kids, love the wife, and you're just not quite there. And you don't feel you fit in. And so it can magnify things because you've left this whole life. You're trying to return to it, but you're not quite there for many of them. And then you've got the whole set of experiences. You've got the fact that you're on alert all the time. You know, a car backfires, and it's like you're back on the streets of Basra. And it's just very, very hard for a lot of people to live with this.
One of the things that shocked me about learning about these crimes, about, you know, maybe a dozen soldiers all getting arrested for senseless shootings, basically, is how easy it is. It seems like a long way to go from being a law-abiding, normal person to a murderer, but really it isn't. Okay, these are guys who have extensive weapons training. They know how to not only use a weapon, but at least all the ones I'd spoken to had killed people in Iraq. One of the guys had killed over 60 people.
In the wars that we've had recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have, as you do in counterinsurgency type situations, you have an enemy who can't be distinguished from the civilian population. You don't know who's your enemy, so you're on a constant alert. You're fearing people on a daily basis. You're sometimes killing people without being completely certain as to who they were, because that's the nature of these types of actions.
Now, take a young man with that kind of training, that kind of experience, bring him home. Give him lots of alcohol, because that's what they did to medicate themselves. Give them some drugs. They were looking for the high of combat, and a lot of times they replaced it with crystal meth, cocaine. Give them a loaded weapon that they carry at all times. And that's what these guys did. For some reason, they didn't feel safe when they came home. And the thing that made them feel safe was carrying a loaded weapon. And they all did it. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of people in Colorado Springs right now who are doing it. Now, you combine all those things and add a little stress, a fight with somebody, someone cutting you off, a bad day. And it's very easy to kill somebody. And then you cross the line, and it's a very thin line between thinking it and doing it and having done it.
John Turner served as a Marine infantryman in Iraq, including tours in Fallujah and Ramadi. Since returning from war, he has become a peace activist and a vocal advocate for healing of soldiers' mental wounds.
You know, it's so easy to send somebody off to do dirty work, but come home and there's nothing, man. There's no purification, right? There's no ceremony to welcome you back to being home. And it's a shame. And it took me a long time to realize that I was home. You know, I've been back for 6 years, almost 6 years now. And I've still never had a proper welcoming ceremony.
A lot of the guys that I've talked to said that they wished there was something more sort of structured and removed from society that was sort of a halfway house in between combat and home. You know, they feel, especially guys that go back and forth every couple of years, are just yo-yoed between two worlds and find that they belong in neither.
It's a very hard thing to do, because even when they try and set up programs, they have it on the ships coming back, and there was a period where they put people on ships rather than airplanes to give them a period of decompression. But all the soldiers want to do is get home to their families. And, you know, so even if you set up programs, they don't want to be thinking about it. And it's a very hard task. You don't just turn on a killer and then turn them off.
All of a sudden, you're in theater and you're being blown up. And then 2 days later, you're looking at your family on, you know, in the green. It's a wild experience. And you don't care, because all you want to do is get home. That's all that matters, is getting home. But what is so important is that time in between there to talk the stories over with your friends, with your buddies that you were in those experiences with. And that's got to be one of the hardest transitions in the world, you know?
The story, I think, touched me more than any others in these interviews was the story of a guy named John Needham. He's a kid from California. Actually, he was a professional surfer before he joined the Army. And he joined the Army pretty late in 2004, when it was clear that the Iraq War was going pretty badly. And he thought to himself, well, here it is. Here's a time when my country actually needs me, and I'll sign up. And by all accounts, he was the best soldier in his platoon, the right hand of the lieutenant, big, strong, smart, good-looking. Everyone liked him. According to him, on their tour in Baghdad, his platoon went dark. They started doing things that he thought were unnecessary. They started, for example, mutilating dead bodies and putting them on their Humvee and then driving around the neighborhood, which they suspected was full of insurgents, and they were probably right, and saying, "You are next." They started killing people that he thought didn't deserve to be killed. A kid on a bicycle, a guy walking down the street, and they would cover it up. And he didn't want to do that, and he turned against his platoon, and they turned against him, and he felt trapped in this position where he didn't know there was no way out. It eventually drove him crazy, and he tried to shoot somebody in his platoon. After that happened, they sent him back to Fort Carson, because the model of that battalion was, if someone starts acting crazy and they're too dangerous to be in Baghdad, send them back to Colorado Springs. That's obviously a very dangerous solution for everybody. He got back to Colorado Springs, and they told him they were going to court-martial him for trying to shoot someone in his platoon, someone he believed was doing something very illegal. Fortunately, his father, who is a well-educated, retired Army officer, intelligence officer, intervened and said, look, this kid doesn't need to be punished. He needs help. And so they got him into treatment for PTSD, but it wasn't effective. It wasn't effective, and his father finally brought him home after he retired from the Army. He couldn't hold a job. He just stayed inside all day, and he would have these flashbacks, usually during the middle of the night, where he would take off all his clothes and think he was back in Iraq, and he would hide behind furniture, thinking that there were insurgents everywhere. You know, his father didn't know what to do. He tried to get him committed to the VA hospital because he needed inpatient care, but there was no room, and he didn't qualify. He was arrested. He got out on bail, miraculously. His father put up, I think, about $200,000 in bail. And he later died under very uncertain circumstances of a drug overdose, whether it was intentional or accidental. But he was a guy who was so together, was such a sort of a someone who had everything, who was just totally undone by his experience until he had nothing left. And I think about him all the time, and how it could have been really different for him.
Everything that I've gone through, everything that my friends have gone through, I've forgiven. You know, and it's just, I can keep saying that word, and hopefully it has set in somewhere in every person, you know, forgive, 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 and learn. It doesn't matter what someone did to you, it's not going to make a difference. And there's a huge split between veterans. I don't want to label people as being pro-war veterans or anti-war veterans, but there is like a split in the middle. And then there's the people who are just hush-hush and don't talk about their experience. And I've had a couple of friends that people that they knew in college didn't even know that they were a veteran for like 3 years of knowing them, you know? And that all goes back to being afraid to tell your story to somebody. But our stories are what matter. You know, this is really what is going to change our future and change our lives for our children and our grandchildren. And every generation to come is, they have to know of our mistakes. You know, just as much as we have to know of our mistakes and where we've made faults in our lives. Because if we keep doing the same shit over and over again, everyone is still going to be suffering.
We didn't have to go into Iraq. We didn't have to be there. We didn't have to do all the things that we did there. And we did. And one of the reasons that we did is I think that the American public, which is reasonable and averse to war but not opposed to it, was sold a bum bill of goods. If you had said to them, look, we're going to have guys like this, guys like the Lethal Warriors, we're going to have it for decades. It doesn't go away, and we don't really have a good way of treating it. I think people would have given things a second thought. And that's really why I've tried to do what I do, is that if you don't have all the information, you can't make the right decision. And I don't think we did. And I hope next time we do.
We have seen the destruction war brings to all sides. We have struggled to comprehend the horrors of war inflicted through more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, or envision the many years of healing these millions of soldiers and civilians require. Legacy and fallout of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars belong to my generation and those that will come after us. We've grown up watching these wars unfold through events like Abu Ghraib, Haditha, and the Stryker 5 killings. We've seen the million U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan return home to face increased unemployment, high rates of alcohol and drug dependence, mental trauma, and suicide as a result of their experiences in battle. A number of factors contributed to the misconduct and crimes committed by members of the American military, both abroad and upon returning home. Some soldiers should not have been in the military or in conflict zones in the first place, whether due to behavioral issues or underlying mental disorders. What lessons should my generation and future generations of Americans take from Iraq and Afghanistan? To better screen who we put in uniform and train to kill? To properly train and supervise members of the military and maintain high standards for conduct? To better recognize and treat trauma from military service? All of these things, clearly. But the common element in these horrific events is war itself. Fighting better supervised wars with a better screened and better trained military will do little to shield against the horror of war as a traumatic experience. Even as the U.S. welcomes its soldiers home from Iraq and Afghanistan and realizes the damage done to thousands of its own, some of our leaders call for additional wars. So the question remains, have we really learned the cost of war?
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading Psychological Tools and Moral Hazards of Drone Warfare. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On what would be the last day of his life, Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S.-based NGO, was being watched by a remote crew piloting a Predator drone above the skies of Kabul, Afghanistan. As Ahmadi went about his work running a series of errands across the city, the drone operators, though they did not know his identity, were making plans to kill him. A series of innocuous actions like Ahmadi loading water containers into his car were interpreted in the minds of the operators watching as sinister preparations for a suicide bomb attack. After surveilling Ahmadi for several hours, the drone operators issued a death sentence, firing a hellfire missile at his car as he drove up to his home just as three children were rushing out to greet him. A total of 10 people, all civilians, were killed in the attack that the U.S. military had initially insisted had targeted a terrorist working with the Daesh. The death of Ahmadi and his family members were unique in the level of public attention they received. It was sadly unremarkable, though, in the context of the larger U.S. drone war that has been waged over the past 20 years. Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Freed from the traditional reciprocity of war in which both sides put their lives on the line, drone operators have become more like judicial executioners, putting people on trial on the other side of the planet without due process and meting out death sentences by remote control. The U.S. pioneered this style of warfare but is no longer alone in using what is technically called unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs. Other countries, including U.S. rivals, are ramping up their own drone programs, signaling that this style of killing at great distance is likely to become a defining feature of war in the 21st century. Other drone operators describe experiencing physiological distress during their missions, as well as brief bursts of adrenaline following successful shots that supported friendly ground forces engaged in active combat. When they were asked to describe their worst day on the job, many of their responses dealt with what drone crews saw in the aftermath of certain strikes. One sensor operator on a drone described their worst day to Phelps this way: watching the son of the person I just obliterated with a hellfire missile pick up the pieces of his father. It wasn't the act of killing I focused on. It was watching the boy's face and interactions with the rest of his family that continue to haunt me, unquote. In countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the U.S. has carried out thousands of strikes in the absence of a meaningful U.S. ground presence. The people being killed on the ground in these strikes usually do not and indeed cannot pose any conceivable threat to Americans. Rennie argues, with reference to philosophical traditions like just war theory, that this makes even many purportedly legitimate drone targets, particularly the low-level rural foreign fighters who bear the brunt of drone program, little different from civilians. The concept of war as a legal and morally regulated activity was historically built on an assumption of mutual risk and danger among those taking part. That dynamic simply no longer exists when one side is fighting only with robots from the other side of the planet. While prior technological advances may have reduced the structural threat between combatants, drone warfare is the first time that one side has made themselves absolutely immune to violence. Redick writes, UAV-exclusive violence marks a fundamental shift in the nature of hostilities from an adversarial contention to something more closely approximating judicial sanction. One outcome of this shift has been dehumanization of those targeted by the United States. What emerges in place of war as a situation of mutual risk is simply an unending series of executions carried out from the skies. The task of the people carrying out many strikes is less about overcoming an enemy in battle than issuing moral judgments and death sentences against individuals who pose no conceivable threat to the U.S. and whose customs, circumstances, and even identities are often unknown to them. To use a chilling metaphor, Renick argues that killing through drone strikes outside of active combat situations is less like war, as traditionally defined, and more like a creative process of disinfection. In cases where drones are targeting high-level terrorists who are directly planning attacks against the U.S. or where they're supporting friendly ground forces in combat, the strikes are more justifiable according to traditional moral schema. These are not often the circumstances of drone strikes. Thousands of strikes have taken place outside of active combat zones over the years or have targeted low-level fighters or even unarmed individuals who posed no direct threat to U.S. forces or even civilians. An investigative report recently published by the military-focused news site Connecting Vets, including leaked footage of many strikes, outlined the extent to which U.S. military commanders became obsessed with killing low-level suspected Taliban members in Helmand Province, Afghanistan during a 2019 drone campaign. After initially trying to cover up the killings of Zimari Ahmadi and his family in Kabul, the Pentagon subsequently backtracked following a stream of news reports disproving their narrative about killing ISIS terrorists. Though it was forced to admit responsibility, the military has said that no disciplinary action would be taken against anyone involved in the attack that took the lives of 10 members of an innocent family. If drone warfare, whether autonomous or not, is to have any moral component at all, it must include some accountability for the innocent people regularly killed in strikes like the one that ended the life of Zimari Ahmadi. Periodic apologies aside, moral responsibility toward the tens of thousands killed, maimed, or deprived of their loved ones over the past 20 years has been in short evidence. Amal Ahmadi, Zimari's brother, told reporters in the aftermath of the drone strike, "That is not enough for us to say sorry. The United States of America can see from everywhere. They can see that there were innocent children near the car and in the car. Whoever did this should be punished. It is not right."
simple question.
Is the UK's ambulance service in crisis? Recent news reports have revealed there are now too few crews to keep up with demand and the close to million calls they get every month. Despite limited resources, the ambulance crews are doing their best, but they know there is little prospect of a reduction in the massive pressures they have to endure every day.
Dealing with the increased number of calls caused by COVID has made the problems worse. However, the underlying issues are related to a rise in general demand for ambulance services and a fall in those currently employed to deliver it. Thousands of paramedics have left the ambulance service, leading to a shortfall that those who remain must try and cope with. The impact is clear and concerning. The service struggles to cope with demand, and as a result, ambulance service crews are regularly missing the time targets set for them. This in turn is increasing the level of stress on those who remain in the ambulance service. Indeed, stress-related illness amongst paramedics has gone up, with reported cases in the service increasing by 71% during the coronavirus pandemic.
How would it feel to wait for hours for an ambulance to arrive? And are the public concerned about a potentially growing shortage of ambulance crews for the winter ahead? Simple questions with important answers. Now let's start with this. Over the last 2 years, thousands of paramedics have left the service. How does the public feel about that? We put it to them outside this major hospital in London. Here's what they told us.
I feel that it takes a toll and effect on people because people are needing help. They've got no source of transport, no support, nothing to get to a hospital, you know. And some people live by themselves or are single parents, whatever. They've got no one to help them there.
They're understaffed and they should be properly funded, and there should be the money's there, so there should be the right funding for the right sectors. And if the money's there, then where is this money going? It's not to the right places.
Well, I think the government would need to do something about that because there are a lot of people that do need healthcare services. I think they need to recruit more drivers.
I think that's bad because like ambulances are very important, and like if it takes long, it can affect someone's chance of surviving. So that's not a good thing.
It makes me feel quite upset. So I think that we need those people. That those are the most vital people in life, basically in every country. So yeah, like we definitely need to get those numbers back so people can fill in those positions.
Well, I think I can understand it. I'm surprised that they've been able to cope as well as they seem to have, you know, over the past 18 months. It seems to be just relentless and quite thankless too. You know, you hear about aggression towards ambulance drivers and that, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's probably, it is sad, but I guess it's all the pressure that's on them, you know, dealing with social issues as well as the...
Well, concerned, for sure, because of safety. If we need service, what do we do? How do we go about it and get treated, you know, and so on. So, yeah. But also, I'm a bit more concerned about the level of violence towards them, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard good things. I don't really know much about it. It seems pretty easy to get services. I know getting vaccinated was kind of difficult for some of my friends, which was like it was a priority for them to get vaccinated, so I think that might have been difficult. But yeah, I guess other than that, I've been able to access all the services I need. So, and as someone who's not actually...
A bit concerning, to be honest. I've only had one personal experience where I've had to call an ambulance in the UK, and I did find that the wait time was already quite long. So I think if there's any further reductions, it's just going to get worse and worse, and people are going to be waiting longer and longer. It's hard enough, as is, I think, with London, especially because of the traffic. It's hard to get ambulance to places they need to be with enough of them on the road, let alone if they remove some of them. So
it's scary because, like, we need the NHS. Like, we need... A lot of people can't afford privatised healthcare, so, like, having fewer ambulances means, like, probably more deaths, more, like... things that could have been prevented if we did have the right amount of funding and for the NHS and the ambulance.
fact that there are fewer ambulance staff. I mean, I haven't ever needed any ambulance resource, but my first instinct is that it sounds like it's something that's critical.
Well, I used to be a care worker myself, so that wasn't for the NHS, though I have worked for the NHS since. But the main issue is really low rates of pay, long hours, not very much encouragement, and a little, and a climate that whatever you do, it's going to be wrong.
I need to see the data to say if it's right or not, because I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that the waiting time is longer to just get to the GP, that's for sure. At the same time, you know, if we want to have more staff, then we need to allocate more resources to that. And then, well, the funding obviously will have to change, so we need to cut it from somewhere else or collect more in taxes. So that's, you know.
Why can't the NHS retain enough staff to run the ambulance service? Here's the public's opinion.
Many, many things, many reasons come to mind. You know, pay, level of working conditions, level of pay, treatment by others, the attacks on people. The list goes on.
I'd say it would be a combination of things that probably to do with pay, maybe something to do with Brexit as well, and probably just a whole different range of things.
I think probably burnout. You know, I think, the best of times, it's quite a difficult job to, you know, it's not like going to your job and then just going home again. I think, you know, they're in there for long hours and they see a lot of difficult situations, and it's probably very hard for them to switch off. So if they're being overstretched, I imagine mentally it would be very difficult to cope, apart from any of the other, you know, aggressions that they might face during the job, you know, which would discourage them.
I guess because it's like an extremely under strain situation, and people aren't, probably don't feel especially valued.
I mean, I've been in the Canadian system since I was born, so I've never had any health issues either, so I can't really speak to that. But I think it's, so far it's been quicker to get tests and prescriptions that I need here than it has been at home. So that's something, I guess, yeah.
I think especially in the past year with coronavirus, they've been under a lot of stress. It's been very difficult for a lot of those staff. It might be that some of them can't take the pressure of it anymore, and they're just not getting the same treatment and respect that they should be getting. So, probably looking for a different job.
I feel like it could be a danger, but I feel like it could be, like, easy sword as well. Because, like, obviously with Corona, it was affected a lot, but I feel like we can bounce back from that. So I feel like it could get back to a good position.
I think it's the government. I feel like the funding for the NHS, including the ambulance and, like, everything like that, the government is cutting down on, and we need to, like, increase the budget and for the NHS.
I can only assume the recent 2 years, where I think people have been working under such stress without recovery time, with a lot of anxiety, and I get the impression that there's not very much resource and there's not very much support for them.
There's a lot of competition for jobs out there, pay's not very good, but the NHS costs the government a great deal of money, and I would imagine the government is struggling to find enough money to pay for all that, so it's in the same problem as a lot of employers have, which is finding enough money to pay wages that will attract people and get them to stay. It's not an easy problem to solve.
I'm not sure if it's less and less in people wanting to work for there. I think the demand is just higher. I think there's more and more people who need it, and I think the supply just doesn't meet it of the work stuff, but maybe there is less of people working as well. But for sure, I think there's just more people, like, coming to the UK in general.
It's stress from probably overwork and the amount of work that's expected from them, and you know, trying to keep a brave face for the people that they're dealing with. Yeah.
I think there's something secretly going on that the public don't know about. As we all know, government always hides a bit more than what we know. Obviously, they're not getting paid enough for the great work they do. That, I can't say I know, but you can tell from an outside point of view that something is not going right.
Yeah, stress, underfunding, severe underfunding, cuts, and it's one thing when the NHS is not properly funded, and another when Boris and his mates can just get their pay rises, and then so obviously the money's there because you know it's there. You can see where the money's going, and it's not going in the right places. So I imagine that if they don't feel appreciated, what was it last year? People were on their doorsteps clapping for them. But yeah, that's all well and good, but it's just gestures at the end of the day, and they should be properly paid, and maybe then they wouldn't be having to leave.
Possibly because everybody wants to be safe and stay alive for their families. It might have something to do with the wages that they're being paid. Maybe the government needs to think about increasing their wages, and that might possibly retain the staff.
Yeah, probably stress and pay and everything as well. Maybe abroad they might get better money and things like that, possibly.
We're heading into winter, and ambulance professionals are warning that things will get worse.
Yeah, again, it's very concerning if that is the case, where there's more and more people leaving the profession and there's not enough people to actually backfill them. It's naturally concerning to anybody, really, and I think whoever are the policy makers need to do something about it to address that issue and be a little bit more transparent about it.
Regarding to your question, I just think that NHS did a lot for our country or from all the citizens of this country and for everyone. They looking after everyone like we are their own family, and also they maybe they are fed up a little bit like everyone, because if they are working too much and their work is not appreciated, obviously they are fed like a bit tired, just keeping working hard and maintain our healthy and to protect us. So it's like they're doing a really hard job for us to keeping everybody safe. And I think like everyone, they before their duties and their job, they are human exactly like us. So I think they are a bit tired at the moment because they was working too hard to keeping everybody safe.
I mean, it's a little bit concerning. I know that people who work paramedics and people who work in that field are extremely valuable, and I think it's really important to pay them what they deserve, make sure that they have good working conditions, and do whatever's necessary to make sure that those services are accessible and available to people.
It's going to take a toll, and it's going to get scary. As you know, we're in a pandemic, and the crime is getting worse. Even the police, not just the ambulance, the police, they don't answer for hours. Imagine you're calling the police asking for help, you're going to get stabbed or anything, and they don't answer. You're on a 1-hour hold, and then no one comes. Just like the ambulance, your life is gone within seconds.
Oh, it's terrible. It's really horrible because, I mean, we live in like quite a progressive country where we should have these services very available, and the fact that they're not shows you something about the current state of this country.
That would be really devastating to know that, on the other line of the telephone, if you call 999, there's nobody to pick up the call. We do need that support, and we do pay our taxes for these services, so they should be made available.
I think there needs to be better methods of getting the ambulances